88.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz. You can stream KPFA online or listen to our archive shows anytime at kpfa.org.
Good morning and happy May Day. It is Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. This is Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Teeker. Coming up in the show, really big news. We're going to break it here, and we can't tell you what it is until the last 10 minutes of the program. So stick around until then. We're going to be talking about the Golden State Killer. Turns out he was a cop. Also turns out they found him through DNA evidence that he did not put on the internet, but a distant relative did. We're going to talk about what that means for data and privacy. Also, Fernando Carrillo thought he was clear of immigration problems. Now he's being called in to check in with ICE. We've been tracking his story. We're going to talk about why the federal government is appealing a judge's decision to let him stay.
And then we are going to speak with Obi Anthony, who is the founder of Exonerated Nation, an organization that serves California's exonerees. There have been almost 200 people exonerated in California in the last decade and a half, and California gives them $1,000, says thanks and good luck. Exonerated Nation is working on some legislation that would change that. And then we'll get an update on the South Carolina prison rebellions, talking to Sandra Scott, executive director of the ACLU of South Carolina.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about peace on the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about so much more, some of which we cannot even tell you about. Next,
big, big things coming up on Upfront after these newest headlines.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. The United Nations Nuclear Agency says it believes Iran had a coordinated nuclear weapons program in place before 2003, but found no credible indications of such work after 2009. The agency issued its assessment a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released what he said was a half ton of seized documents that he claimed proved Iran lied about its nuclear intentions.
Incriminating documents, incriminating charts, incriminating presentations, incriminating blueprints, incriminating photos, incriminating videos, and more.
The documents focused on Iranian activities before 2003 and did not provide any evidence that Iran has violated the 2015 deal with the international community. Netanyahu's speech was delivered in English and appeared to be aimed at giving Donald Trump one more reason to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. Trump said the discovery vindicated his criticism of the international agreement.
And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but a lot of people think they know. And on or before the 12th, we'll make a decision.
By May 12th, Trump will decide whether to pull the U.S. out of the agreement. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, belittled Netanyahu in a tweet saying, quote, "The boy who can't stop crying wolf is at it again." He later tweeted, quote, "President Trump is jumping on a rehash of old allegations already dealt with by the IAEA to nix the deal." White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is dismissing as total BS a report that he has referred to Trump as an idiot. On one occasion, Kelly reportedly worried Trump would make a deal for the undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers that wouldn't be harsh enough on immigration. NBC reports two sources saying that Kelly derided Trump, saying, quote, "He doesn't even understand what DACA is. He's an idiot." After the NBC report first aired, Trump went on Twitter to accuse what he calls the fake news of making up false stories and using unnamed sources he says don't exist. Former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was similarly reported as having called Trump a moron. Trump fired Tillerson via Twitter in March. U.S. border officials allowed in for processing eight of the Central American asylum seekers who are part of a caravan waiting at the border at Tijuana, Mexico. Other migrants celebrated the development. About 140 others are still waiting in Mexico to turn themselves in at San Diego's San Ysidro border crossing. They include this mother of three from Honduras.
I decided to join the caravan because I didn't have another option. The people who are chasing after me found me in Tapachula. Staying in Mexico is not an option. I need to be helped for Donald Trump to listen to me. I can't return to Honduras because I'll be killed together with my children. My children are an easy prey for the gangs, and I don't want that.
Some parents may be separated from their children and detained for months while their asylum cases are pending. Trump administration officials have railed against what they call legal loopholes and catch-and-release policies that allow people seeking asylum to be freed while their cases are adjudicated. Vice President Mike Pence toured the California border yesterday.
This situation is a direct result of our weak immigration laws and our porous border.
The Justice Department said it filed illegal entry charges against 11 people it identified as caravan members. There was no immediate confirmation that claim was accurate. May Day celebrations around the Bay Area today will focus on immigrants, workers, and renters' rights. In Oakland, longshore workers, ILWU Local 10 will gather at 10 a.m. at the Oakland Matson Terminal. At 3 p.m., a rally at Oakland's Frank Ogawa, also known as Oscar Grant Plaza downtown. In San Jose, demonstrators gather at 4 at King and Story Roads. In Concord, a Homes for All campaign seeking relief from soaring rents, evictions, and displacement takes place from 4 to 6 at Meadow Homes Park, 1351 Detroit Avenue. In Richmond, immigrants' rights advocates will gather outside the Contra Costa County Jail, which has a contract with federal immigration authorities. Religious leaders will negotiate with authorities to restore a visitation program for undocumented immigrants held at the jail. The event begins at 9:30. In Santa Rosa, demonstrators will gather at 2 with a march at 3:30 to downtown. A freight train derailed near the Shell oil refinery in Martinez early this morning. KTVU reported it was believed the train was backing into the refinery when it went off the tracks at Shell and Marina Vista Avenues. Two tankers were leaning off the tracks but had not tipped over. Attorneys representing thousands of former students of the now bankrupt Corinthian colleges were in federal court to bring back an Obama-era loan forgiveness program. The Trump administration reversed the loan forgiveness program and replaced it with a new formula giving students partial relief based on income. Eileen Connor is an attorney with the Project on Predatory Student Lending. The organization seeks relief for students defrauded by for-profit colleges.
Even when people take advantage of programs like income-based repayment, where they earn so little that they're able to make a $0 payment and be considered in good standing on their loans, it's not curing the difficulty that people are in because the loans are still on their credit reports. There's a psychological impact of having debt, especially when it's the product of an illegitimate school. All of those harms aren't really resolved by income-based repayment.
At its height, Corinthian operated more than 100 campuses in 25 states, enrolling 110,000 students. It collected $1.7 billion in federal student aid. Corinthian folded in 2015 after the Education Department cut off its access to federal aid after determining it lied about student graduation and job placement rates. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy in the morning, then sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 60s. In Fresno, the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers and afternoon thunderstorms, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. We're News at 94.1 at 7:30.
It is 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. Good morning, Kat Brooks.
Good morning, Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
How'd things go while I was gone?
You know, Brian, it never goes as well without you as it does you. So I was... Well, you too, Mitch Jezrich,
whatever.
Cranky man in the corner.
Mitch Jezrich
hasn't gone as
back.
Well without whatever. You either, sir.
Whatever.
How was your trip? Where did you go? What did you do?
Well, I went to Greece. I went to Athens, which our very clever engineer has called... I think aptly so. White people's Wakanda.
You know, when you said you were going to visit the ruins of a collapsed civilization, I thought it was another reporting trip to D.C.
Well, you know, no, I wanted to go see. I don't even know what to say to that. Yeah,
you had to come home for that.
It was a real trip, though. Yeah, it was quite a trip. Athens was quite a trip. We're worth doing. And I said this right before I left, but one of the reasons I went is because, you know, I like to study history, and I know one of the few ways that I actually, and I never studied ancient Greece in school or on my own. And so one way I make myself study is I say, okay, I'll go there. And then it's a whole process, right? Spend several months ahead reading everything I can about it. Then you go there and you see things you've read about. And it's sort of I like to consider it a learning tour. So.
And then you teach all of us through your posts on Facebook, which I followed pretty closely.
Well, you know, it's a, yeah, thank you.
I was like, Mitch is so diagonal places and go, ooh, look pretty. Mitch goes, takes a picture and breaks down the whole history and relevance of whatever he's taking a picture of.
Yeah. Did you?
And also my follies too.
Did you witness
about my follies?
Did you witness or participate in any popular uprisings?
No, you know, it's really interesting. Athens is somewhat like Oakland in a way, and also a lot like Mexico, in fact. But there's street art everywhere. You know, some people call it graffiti, whatever it may be. But I saw there are just a number of anarchist tags everywhere. And in fact, there was even one advertising Taekwondo for Antifa.
Shut up. Did you take a picture of that?
Oh, yeah. It's on my Facebook cat.
Yes,
I don't know how you missed that one. It's one of 200 pictures. So that was really interesting. I certainly saw posters around leading up to today, what will be May Day protest in Athens, which of course for us is Law Day, but May Day for the rest of the world.
Why do you say it's Law Day?
Because that's officially what it is here in the United States. It's Law Day, even though May Day, as a labor activist, and of course immigrants really put it back on the map for us back in 2006. But officially, it's Law Day, even though May Day as a Labor Day began in the United States. But after the Russian Revolution and the Cold War, Dwight Eisenhower in the 1950s changed it to Law Day.
But what does
day,
that mean?
And a day to observe the importance of law and order in society, right?
Which Cat's is favorite holiday,
which is quite antithetical. But what May Day was about, right? May Day, you know, it commemorates the Haymarket Square affair that happened in 1886 in Chicago. There was a general strike, and during this last several days on May 4th, 1886, an unidentified person set off a bomb somewhere. Police began responding by shooting into the crowd, killing many people, but it also obviously would bring a riot, which it did. Police officers as well were killed. They later would round up the leaders of the general strike and eventually execute four of them, including Albert Parsons,
the husband
who I know
Lucy
you did.
Parsons.
You did a show on Lucy Parsons not too long ago. And then a few years later was the Second International proclaimed that May 1st should be a day in which all labor organizations and socialist groups and communist groups should use to have demonstrations. And of course, what was going on in 1886 is it was a general strike for the 8-hour workday, which is really fascinating to me because we take it for granted. Well, maybe we don't take it for granted around here.
We don't work 8 hours.
But
a day.
You know, but it's the law now, and I don't think we think a lot about it. But you know, it was enough to have a general strike over back in 1886 for an 8-hour workday, and that's what that was for. But then the Russian Revolution happened, and at first it wasn't changed. It was a holiday at first. It was a May Day holiday. It was our Labor Day here in the United States. After the Russian Revolution, there were activists who tried to change it to the Americanization Day. And this happened, I think, in 1923. And then about 30 years later, a little over 30 years later, Dwight Eisenhower officially made it Law Day.
And today we'll be celebrating May Day in
well, I don't know what country you're in.
International Workers' Day will be celebrated here in Oakland. There is a march in Oakland, no ban, no raids, no wall, sanctuary for all at 3 p.m. in Oscar Grant Plaza. There's a march leaving Oscar Grant Plaza, which is 14th and Broadway for the uninitiated, at 4 p.m. for the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. That's being put on by Oakland Sin Fronteras. And there is also an ILWU rally that starts at 10 a.m. at the Matheson Port. That will then march to Little Bobby Hutton Park, that's Defermery Park for the uninitiated, and then meet up in Oscar Grant Plaza.
And across the bay, there's going to be a separate, smaller action outside of ICE headquarters in San Francisco at 630 Sansome. Those of you listening may remember an ICE deportation story we've been tracking quite closely. This is the story of Fernando Carrillo. basically has been in the country since he was a teenager, but got here like a year too late to be eligible for the DACA relief that was put into place under the Obama administration. Picked up a DUI a couple of years ago, put him on the radar of ICE. Once Trump came into office, they decided to pursue him and did it by following him as he dropped his daughter off at daycare. That kind of made him a national headline at the time of his detention. Very little press stayed on him afterwards. He decided to fight deportation. He could not get bond, so he stayed in jail in beds that are rented from the Contra Costa County Sheriff at the West County Detention Facility in Richmond for 6 months. And finally, he and his incredibly resourceful wife, Lourdes Barraza, who is doing all the outside organizing, and their attorney, convinced the judge that he faced a real threat of persecution if he went back to Mexico, and he should be allowed to stay, effectively given asylum. Last we spoke to them, little under a month ago, right after he got out, they thought this is it. They're done. They can start putting their lives together. They can start paying off all the debt the family had to take on just to, like, pay rent while he wasn't working, as well as pay for attorney's fees. Just got notice that the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security, is appealing that judge's decision. I have not yet looked up statistics on how common that is, but it is hard not to see it as payback because they made this a very public case. They put on rallies in front of the West County detention facility. They made national headlines. I think this is an embarrassing story for the Trump administration to be picking someone up while he's dropping his daughter off at daycare. In any case, he has his first check-in today. He has to start checking in with ICE again. As we know, those check-ins can end with detention without notice.
That's right.
His supporters are going out at 2:30 at 630 Sansom Street in San Francisco. That's an hour before his check-in scheduled, but they'll be rallying until it is scheduled at 3:30.
That's all I got on that one. Just disgust.
Yeah.
And not only could it lead to detention, we know in these cases that get a lot of media attention, they can also lead to rapid, like, expedited deportations in order to keep.
Yeah, I don't think in this case it can, because the only judge's decision so far is he gets to
stay. The decision has to be overturned. Before.
Exactly.
And this is what we're going to spend resources on.
Well.
Really.
It's what they're going to spend our resources on.
It's a good thing there's not, like, lots of unhoused people all over the country that need food and shelter and stuff.
Or even, I mean, shouldn't we be in another war soon?
At any second now, I'm sure.
The deadline for the Iran deal is approaching.
Yeah. Yes.
You follow what Netanyahu's saying, and Trump now tweeting after saying, see, I knew it, even though Netanyahu, apparently what he has said, saying that he has proof that Iran lied about its nuclear program. Every other agency involved in this, looking at Iran's capabilities, said, yeah, this is stuff we already know. This is not a surprise to anyone. This is not a big deal.
And Iran talking tough, too.
Well, yeah, they have to, right? I mean, that's what they're going to do. I mean,
that if America doesn't lift up its end of the deal, there'll be bad consequences for America.
Yeah. You know, when I was in Athens, there was a lot of attention, and I imagine there was a lot of attention here as well. But in Europe, when I was following European media, there was a lot of attention on Emmanuel Macron's visit here in Washington and meeting with Donald Trump, and especially his speech to a joint session of Congress. And a lot of the attention was about what's going on with Iran and just the implications of what breaking this deal or tearing up this deal now means, especially as everyone's saying Iran's so far abiding by the deal. What it means for the international agreements, right, that one president can make an agreement, another president then would come in and break that agreement.
Right.
And what does that mean for international agreements in general?
What does it mean for the Korean Peninsula?
What does it mean for the Korean Peninsula? Why this is happening at the same time? I mean, I think it's great what Kim Jong-un and what's happening between North Korea and South Korea. I think this is all really positive. I can't help but think of, you know, Libya. What happened after Gaddafi gave up his weapons? And I would be shocked if Kim Jong-un wasn't thinking about these type of things. But the deal, you know, I think another important aspect about this Iran deal shows the weakness of Congress, which we've talked a lot about over the years. The reason why the president can back out of this deal is because Barack Obama, just like with immigration, it was more just through executive actions and executive orders and decisions and never got it ratified, never got this deal anyways ratified through Congress. If this is something that would have been ratified through Congress, and he probably couldn't get it ratified through Congress. And at the time, I thought the deal was a good thing. At the time, I thought DACA was a good thing. But it shows what happens when in our political system, when Congress becomes ineffective and just only does opposition type of things, I guess. And that's the sense of we lose a sense of stability towards policy of what the country is moving forward with, both on immigration and then also now potentially with international treaties. It's just not the Iran deal. It's free trade deals. Now, people will be like, well, we should get rid of these free trades. That's fair. Well, I guess, you know, except for NAFTA. I mean, Congress did approve that, so to be clear. But again –
But not that we shouldn't get rid of NAFTA.
Yeah, NAFTA contains within it a provision for pulling out in a six-month timetable.
So there you go. I was right, even though I didn't know it.
You're always right, Ms. Deseret.
Most of the time, I don't know it.
Go ahead.
I was going to put this back on script.
Okay.
But you can go on if you want.
I wanted to mention one more event. Friend of the show, Tim Redmond, his organization, 48hills.org, which is a progressive blog about San Francisco, they're having their annual benefit tonight. May 1st. I take it tickets are still available because he wrote to me asking if we could announce it on the air.
Oh, right on. Hey, Tim.
It's going to be headlined by Tom Amiano and Rose Aguilar from KALW. It's at Mission Cultural Center tonight from 6 to 9 p.m. And there's details on their website, 48hills.org. They're a 501c3 and proceeds benefit them.
Mitch, I thought of you when I logged into Facebook yesterday and I looked at Latifah Simons' Facebook post announcing that there will be community members serving as ambassadors, I believe is what they're calling them, in the elevators at Powell Street and Civic Center BART stations in San Francisco, for starters. Because we've had conversations, not on air. I don't know if we've talked about it on air. And I don't think so, because you were hesitant to talk about how not okay the elevators in the BART stations are, but you didn't want to make a fuss, even though you've got the platform to do so, because you were concerned about increased policing.
So you thought of me because, not because I couldn't hold it.
No, no.
Just so we're very clear here.
Because of,
you know, the BART elevators now have this poster on there that say, I'm not a bathroom. But I was like, that's funny. I thought you were.
Because often, unhoused folks, and let's be clear, because unhoused folks don't have anywhere else to go to the bathroom, yeah. And there are no bathrooms inside of those BART, inside of many BART stations. There's one in the West Oakland station that I've been too scared to go inside of. I won't do it. But there's this dual issue, right? People have the right to go to the bathroom and there's nowhere to go, so they're using the elevators. But then folks that are differently abled or have to take the elevator then have to get into the elevator with feces and or urine. So
people with strollers,
strollers,
with bicycles.
Right. All of the things. Bicycles, Brian.
That's how I think.
So the BART board passed this thing. And so they've employed people from a community group out of the Bayview to come be ambassadors in these elevators. And I think it's great. I'm really glad that there's people and not police that are going to be enforcing this. And then I was really, really excited. And I think I tagged Mitch in the post and was like, yay. But then I was like, okay, people still don't have a place to go to the bathroom. And so,
yeah.
Right? So now people really don't have a place to go to the bathroom. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that I think, let me just put it out there. The reason you thought of me probably is because I have talked about it before, and I think we have even talked about it on air. But furthermore, I use a wheelchair. So I use the BART elevators every day, several times a day. And I'm of two minds as well about the issue. On one, it's terrible, actually. I hate it. It's almost every day. It's like the price of admission that you have to usually go through some way, either urine or feces or whatever it would be. It's been this way for a very long time. It's a public health risk. And I think most disabled people know that if the general population had to put up with this, it wouldn't happen, be happening like this. But it's, you get a different standard for disabled people. That said, I also agree completely with you about there is what this does is okay. So they're gonna. I don't know how I feel about it actually, about having these ambassadors at the elevator all the time. But we'll see. I don't know a lot about it, so I'd be remiss to say too much about that very, very thing. But it's not going to help the elevators I use, which is
right because they're in Civic Center.
And it's just as bad. It's not about me. Yeah. It's not about me. keep that in mind.
It's a pilot program. It's going to cost $600,000, which Muni and BART are paying for.
Yeah, it's going to be employing some kids from the Bayview
and some kids from the Bayview. And if the pilot program goes well, then hopefully it will expand to BART stations.
And I'm for creating jobs. Always good stimulus in the economy, right? But again, it doesn't, it doesn't address the bigger issue. And maybe this is something that BART has to burden, because the bigger issue is a societal one, is the fact there is no place if you have no money, no home, for you to be able to go to the bathroom, you go use the restroom. There's very, I say no place, I'm sure there's a few, but not very many, and not very many options. And it's important to keep in mind, we do live in a society that if you don't have money, if you can't buy a cup of coffee, or if you can't buy a burrito at the taqueria, or whatever it is, you can't use the restroom.
Right.
Right? And I get why businesses do that, because if you have everyone using your restroom, well, that's a mess too.
Right? I get it and I don't. Like, I mean, I think there's this piece of social responsibility, right? Like, people need to go to the bathroom, open up the frickin' bathroom, and let people go and clean it. Or why they didn't tack another, I don't know, $50,000 on the $600,000 pilot project and pay for porta potties. Like, to me, it's we've had this conversation.
Which San Francisco has done
in the past. Last week, they allocated a bunch of money for basically cleaning up the city. So it's street cleaning money, but in that money is a pot of money for bathrooms.
Great.
On the street.
I stand corrected.
That will have Sharps collection bins for people who need to dispose of needles.
Wonderful.
And I just would add, it is homeless people often, because I see it oftentimes.
And drunk people.
But that's what I also wanted to say, especially in Oakland, now that you have all those bars over at Uptown. Friday and Saturday night's a terrible time to take a BART, because there are so many people coming out of those bars and just doing their thing right there in the elevator.
Mm.
So it's not just
And that is not about having somewhere else to go.
At all.
Yeah.
So I haven't gotten to sound off about this. I got several texts from people asking me to sound off about it. I've just been busy with other things that we'll talk about later at the end of today's show.
Dun, dun, dun.
But the Golden State Killer was a cop. Worked for the Auburn Police Department.
And the Exeter Police Department.
Yes,
which
indeed.
I don't even know where that is.
I don't either. Auburn is somewhere up north, I think, right?
Do you remember this? This case is like before my time.
No, I do remember it, but I don't know if I remember or if I remember it because I've told you that my illness, my vice is that I binge watch Investigative ID, which like does 24-hour coverage of real life horrible things that human beings do to other human beings. So I can't remember if I remember or if I remember it because they've covered the Golden State Killer several times over the last couple of years. And then, of course, they're covering it again now because James D'Angelo, Joseph James D'Angelo, has been caught at the ripe young age of 72.
So what they're alleging, 12 murders, 15 rapes.
50.
50 rapes. Jeez, I'm so sorry. Over 100 burglaries. And they caught him by collecting genetic evidence from one of the crime scenes, turning it into data, and then searching against a public online database that people use to research their family trees. He had never put his information in this database. But what they were able to do is identify relatives of the likely killer, work back to figure out who the common ancestor was, which was some great grandparent in the 19th century, then work down to figure out who are all the people alive today descended from that person, and then start crossing off people who couldn't have been the killer because they were somewhere else. So this is like a mind-exploding privacy issue.
Yeah, I'm just black people. I need you to pay attention to this. It is mind-exploding privacy issue. Glad he was caught. People that have been lived for decades with the fear and the trauma. Because
have they found any other evidence on him?
Well,
he left DNA at the scene, at one of the scenes, I thought.
Yeah, it's the DNA evidence, and then I assume they went through date, place, and time, and figured out he had no alibis.
Sorry, Kat.
And also, he was purchasing guns, on record purchasing guns in large numbers during the period where the Golden State killings were at a height.
Yeah. But the fact that he never put himself inside of that registry and that's how they caught him just opens, I think, a can of worms that privacy activists should be following.
Yeah, and it also gives you a sense. So when you start amassing data, it doesn't just tell you about the people you have data on. And this is true of Facebook. They create profiles of people who've never created a Facebook account. Right. They buy data from third-party brokers. They can figure out who you have relationships with just by running their facial recognition technology over the photos that other people post. So we all have a data profile, whether we want it to or not. That's used in ways that are entirely out of our control. And it's easy to kind of root for the use in this instance because, you know,
caught a bad guy.
Brought a killer to justice. You know, there may be people doing time right now for crimes he committed, right? And this could help exonerate them. However, have to think about what all the possible misapplications of that technology are. And there's no regulatory oversight. There are no safety rails on how data gets used. It's a conversation that's only barely just beginning in Washington and in Sacramento. And as Mitch pointed out earlier, Washington in particular is not a place that gets things done, and certainly not in a thoughtful way.
And on that cheery note, it is now 7:30 in the morning.
Deep stuff.
It is 7:30 in the morning. We've got a lot to get to. Up next, we're going to be talking to, speaking of there may be people in jail doing time for crimes that the Golden State Killer committed, we're going to be speaking to Obi Anthony. He was incarcerated for 17 years for a murder he did not commit. He is one of 190 Californians that have been exonerated since 1989. When you get out of jail exonerated, which means that they were wrong, you didn't do it, you shouldn't have been in prison, they give you $1,000 and tell you good luck. So Obi is, Anthony and his organization are working to change that. We're going to talk to him, and we're also going to get an update on the South Carolina prison rebellions, talking to the ACLU in South Carolina.
That's all next.
After the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Donald Trump says it's disgraceful that a list of questions that the special counsel investigating Russian election interference wants to ask him was linked to the media. The New York Times published the nearly four dozen questions given to Trump's attorneys. They covered Trump's motivations for firing FBI Director James Comey last May and contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russians. Trump also tweeted, quote, "No questions on collusion. Oh, I see. You have a made-up phony crime, collusion that never existed, and an investigation begun with illegally leaked classified information. Nice," he tweeted. But the questions from the Mueller probe do appear to indicate that Mueller is looking into possible collusion, some touch on Russian meddling, and whether the Trump campaign coordinated in any way with the Kremlin. U.S. border officials have allowed in for processing eight of the Central American asylum seekers who were part of a caravan waiting at the border at Tijuana. About 140 others are still waiting to turn themselves in at San Diego's San Ysidro border crossing. They include this mother of three from Honduras.
"I decided to join the caravan because I didn't have another option. The people who are chasing after me found me in Tapachula. Staying in Mexico is not an option. I need to be helped for Donald Trump to listen to me. I can't return to Honduras because I'll be killed together with my children. My children are an easy prey for the gangs, and I don't want that."
Some parents may be separated from their children and detained for months while their asylum cases are pending. A measure that would require a just cause before a landlord in California could evict a tenant gets a hearing at the state capitol. Oakland Assemblymember Rob Bonta says the state's housing crisis necessitates his legislation to protect tenants against discriminatory, arbitrary, or retaliatory evictions. Currently, California law allows landlords to evict tenants without providing any reason for the eviction. Some cities do require landlords to have a cause before evicting a tenant. That can be failure to pay rent or otherwise violating the lease. Tenants' rights groups say no-cause evictions are most common when ownership of the property changes hands or as retaliation against tenants who assert their rights, usually by requesting repairs. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: partly cloudy in the morning, then sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 60s. In Fresno, the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly cloudy. Slight chance of showers and afternoon thunderstorms, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news in 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
You already know, right? That Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece, is the co-founder of a global grassroots movement to revive democracy. He's also the author of several outstanding books, including Talking to My Daughter About the Economy and the new blistering expose, Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. Both Noam Chomsky and Slavoj Žižek praise him highly. Many consider Varoufakis, this leather-jacketed motorcycling rebel who openly opposes the international corporate class, to be the most interesting man in the world. Are they right? Find out Wednesday evening, May 16 at 7:30, when he'll be at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. This KPFA benefit, wheelchair accessible, will be hosted by the excellent Steve Wasserman of Heyday Books. Tickets at indie bookstores and online at brownpapertickets.com for Yanis Varoufakis, May 16th.
That brings us to 7:35 in the morning. You were listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiger. You know, speaking of the Golden State Killer, there was a headline over the weekend that grabbed my attention. This was reported out by CNN.com. So there's a man named Craig Coley who was convicted for one of the rapes and murders that authorities believe now was done by the Golden State Killer. Served 38 years in prison until investigators went back to the forensic evidence and found that it contained other people's DNA. Obviously, there was no DNA evidence at the time of his conviction. This is part of a wave of people who've been exonerated because of DNA evidence. And aside from the 38 years of his life that were lost, is at least somebody who had access to lawyers and support, because those lawyers finally negotiated a price tag for what he had suffered through by being taken out of society for 38 years, $1.9 million. Far more than many people get when they are cut loose after a wrongful conviction. And in fact, they're not formally entitled to anything. There's like nothing automatic on that, for practically nothing.
No, and I was in Sacramento, last week? Mm-hmm. Before, I don't know. It's a blur.
And most weeks, seems like.
Most weeks are a blur, and most weeks I've been in Sacramento, at least lately. And there was this man, Obi Anthony, that was there, who is the founder of Exonerated Nation. They are working on two bills that will change the way the state of California treats people that are exonerated from California's prisons. According to their website, 190 Californians have been exonerated since 1989. They say collectively they've lost over 1,500 years of their lives. Black people are wrongfully convicted at a rate that is 7 times higher than their white counterparts. And if that were not enough, what I believe I heard Obi say in Sacramento was that California says, oh, oops, we're so sorry, here's $1,000, good luck, and then you have zero access to any of the social safety nets that one would need to rebuild their lives.
Oh, because the conviction makes you ineligible.
That's my understanding, but I want to dig deeper into that. We are joined by Obi Anthony, founder of Exonerated Nation, organization that serves California exonerees. He was incarcerated for 17 years before being exonerated in 2011. Good morning, Obi.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us. I found you incredibly moving speaking at the Capitol the other week. Obi, tell us your story. What happened to you?
What happened to me? Injustice happened to me. So back in 1995, I was convicted of a murder robbery with two attempted murders with three attempted robberies and sentenced to the term of life without the possibility of parole plus 50 years. It wasn't until 2008 when the California Innocent Projects, by way of Northern California Innocent Project and Loyola Project for the Innocent, got involved in my case, began to start doing some reinvestigation of the case, discovered that a couple of different things transpired. One, the prosecutor in the case had withheld information in regards to an informant in which he was using. One, he was calling this informant a witness. And two, he had kept from, not only from the courts, but also from, most importantly, from my defense attorney, that this guy had received a deal for he had been arrested for pimping and pandering. And it was his second strike. He was on his way to prison for 12 years. And they gave him a deal, and they kept that deal away from us and argued inside of the court that this has never happened. Never no deal. Told my lawyer to prove it. Well, that proof didn't come about until 13 years later. And when Deborah Crawford, federal private investigator began to investigate my case and discovered it in the judge's chambers after much investigation. She finally discovered this note in the judge's file indicating that Jones was a snitch and asking the prosecutor whether or not if he wanted him to sentence him then or later. And the prosecutor, George Costello, it doesn't matter, Your Honor, you can sentence him now or later. It was the agreement in which they had, they kept from us. But if my case was real, it would have hosted different other violations. Once the most importantly, starting with the detective that was involved, Marcella Wynn and Pete Brzezinski. Marcella Wynn being a training officer, and this her my case, and Reggie Cole, my co-defendant, being this her first case, was taught by a training officer that, hey, you shouldn't turn over everything to the defense attorney. You give them a chance to beat you. And so they kept a lot of different things out by way of that. And so I was sentenced and sent off to prison in 1996.
And Obi, when you were released and when other exonerees are released, what does the exonerated, meaning that the conviction is overturned, what types of support do you get? What does the state do?
Wow. So the state doesn't. But when I came home, the state did nothing. Absolutely nothing. And that's, one of the main reasons, that is the reason and the purpose of me now. Is because when I came home, as you see and can find, here now, I've been tormented by the psychological effect of prison, right? So I'm paranoid out the game. I'm always anxious. I'm always, communication skills, particularly, is difficult when it comes to significant others and family members because of the lack of over the course of the years. And so I sought to try to, find some help for that. That wasn't there. There was no help for housing there, absent the fact that I came home to my then fiance. I would have, I would have nowhere to go. I had to stay with my attorney up in Northern California for a while before I was able to move in with my fiance. My mother had passed away in 1994, right before my false imprisonment and incarceration. And so I would have been left with nothing. And that's the plight of almost every exoneree that comes home. Exonerees come home to absolutely nothing. No transitional services, no gate money, no medical. They come home with absolutely nothing, and they suffer for years and years. They have problems getting identification, re-entering to jobs, trying to figure out relationships with family members and friends, and all the while dealing with their own sort of psychological effect in regards to what happened to them in prison and suffering that they had for those many years. So we came home and was nothing. And so I now advocate to begin to start putting those things in place, such as what you mentioned earlier, the $1,000. The $1,000 actually is what we're asking for now. It's the least that you can do. We're saying, hey, listen, you give guys who come home on probation and parole gave money to effectuate, have them opportunity to get from the release over into either the parole officer or somewhere to go. You didn't do nothing. You didn't give us no apology. Only thing you did was open the door and close it behind us.
Which bill number is that? Oh, because you're working on two pieces of state legislation, so that's one. Which bill number is that?
So that bill number is SB 1050.
Okay, and so that would give gate money to exonerees. And then what's the second piece of legislation that you're working on?
It's also, which I'm supporting on, is SB 1049. 1049, yeah. And that legislative piece there makes compensation automatic. In my case, I fought for 5 years after my exoneration to receive compensation from the states, and they fought me the entire way, from the Victims Compensation Board from the city to the county. They all fought.
You on what grounds? If you were exonerated, what grounds did they have to fight you on?
Wow, man, what grounds that they can't come up with? And so when it came to the Victims Compensation Board. At that point, their fight was really about not wanting, they didn't want to recognize me as a victim of the state, right? And so they didn't want to say that the state has victimized me, thus giving an opportunity to the city not to settle or to be continue their fight in regards to my civil violations in which the city did for the way the prosecutors and my civil rights are concerned.
So you had to show not just that you were innocent, but that it was wrong for them to go after you in the first place, which is a higher bar.
Right. And so, I mean, you know, they set all sort of obstacles, hurdles. I oftentimes reference hurdles as opportunities to do better because you realize that someone's putting those things in there to make things difficult. So, I mean, that's what they did. The entire process from the moment I walked out of the door all the way until now, until this very day. As you see, I'm still fighting. My fight hasn't stopped. I fought for my freedom when I was in prison. I fought after I came home to be compensated, and now I continue to fight because there's still suffering that's transpiring, not only in my life, but also in my brothers and sisters' lives that also have been exonerated. So,
and that's why you founded Exonerated Nation. What kind of resources does Exonerated Nation provide for people who are exonerated?
So Exonerated Nation has an opportunity to provide exonerees the opportunity for jobs, temporary housing. We've also developed a leadership development, also have a holistic healing retreat, and we also connect them to, those things that when they first come home, help them, with that care package. So when they come home, give them their immediate needs, so basically tending to their immediate needs. And we're also building out other programs right now. I have an opportunity through Working Scholars to begin to start a pilot program, which I'm now, in conversation with Working Scholars to be able to offer free bachelor's degrees to individuals who are exonerated. We're really building up, and it's really about, funds right now, building funds and building an organization. Though I've been doing this work since I walked out of the door 7 years, Exonerated Nation has been founded for the last 2 years. And so we're still new, basically babies in this atmosphere of service. And so we're just trying, at this point, setting out to do the best that we can do to effectuate as many as individuals as possible, realizing there's over 2,000 individuals across the United States that has been wrongfully convicted and incarcerated for crimes in which they didn't commit. That's horrendous. I sometimes question and say to myself, I wonder when the federal government is going to step in and stop these states from doing these violations of these federal civil laws that they violate. We have no Social Security. It's a young man named Andrew Wilson out of the state of California, spent 32 years in prison, 62 years old. How can he effectually receive Social Security or pay him the Social Security? They've taken his entire life from him. And he's not alone. There's a plethora of other individuals that's similar to him. And so, as I always say, the fight continues. It's not a situation, in other words, to take a break. I'm always asked, oh, you should take a break. And I'm like, it's not enough. It's just too much things, too many different things to do to take a break at this point. Too many people suffering, and they need help. And so Exonerated Nation sets out to begin the process of that.
Obi Anthony, if we've got listeners who need some of that support or want to learn more about what you do, where should they go?
So they can go to exoneratednation.org, check up on our website, also go to our Facebook page, Exonerated Nation, and we also have a Twitter also at Exonerated Nation. You can go to those sites, look at our work, follow us, support us, donate, most importantly. Sometimes people tend to believe that $5 doesn't help. That's toothpaste and a deodorant. And so all of those things help. And volunteer your time. And offer up opportunities to other individuals to become aware of the exonerated population. People tend to not know what that is. And so you should be mindful of that, that the states, particularly in the state of California, has taken innocent people out of his population and put them in prison for crimes in which they didn't commit. And when they come home, these same states do nothing, in other words, for what they've done to them. It's like they're that arrogant to believe that they don't make mistakes, even in the face of the 193 that it is now individuals in the state of California that has been wrongfully convicted. And so I advocate for them.
Obi Anthony, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been speaking to Obi Anthony, who is the founder of Exonerated Nation, an organization that serves California exonerees. He was incarcerated for 17 years before being exonerated in 2011.
It's just stunning. I mean, I don't think you can find anybody who could make a credible argument why someone who's been locked up wrongfully for decades shouldn't get money on their way out the door. And the fact that that law is not already in effect just tells you how few people in positions of power actually care.
Well, I think even the general public, like, part of what floored me about him or made me want to bring him on the show after listening to him talk, I think I was walking around with this idea that if people are exonerated, they get this big paycheck and they're able to live out their lives comfortably.
They have That's to bring their see. Own lawsuit.
Right.
Which can take years.
Right. And we didn't get into it. I wanted to talk to him about it, but he did mention at the testimony, the hearing in Sacramento, that people think it's this big fat paycheck, but once you pay for the lawyers for those years and years and years, a significant chunk of that is gone.
And that example I mentioned, the fellow who was wrongfully convicted of what was probably a Golden State killer murder, has not been paid yet. That $1.9 million is only on paper.
Okay, we're going to wrap up this hour, continuing a focus on prisons. On April 15th, a riot broke out in the Lee Correctional Facility in South Carolina. Before it was over, 7 inmates would be dead, many more would be wounded, and accusations that the prison guards stood idly by, well, instigated it and then stood idly by, would run rampant. Lee Correctional Facility is not alone. South Carolina prisons are accused of having some of the most degrading and harsh conditions in the country, and 160 lawsuits have been filed against the state since 2015 related to prison deaths, prison mistreatment, violence, etc. Here to discuss is Chandra Scott, who is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of South Carolina. Good morning, Chandra.
Good morning.
So, Chandra, there's, you know, Lee Correctional Facility has one story, but we're getting stories through cell phones, actually, from other inmates about what happened in the Lee Correctional Facility on April 15th.
Basically, from what I can gather in regard to the different news stories that I saw and different cell phone clippings that I saw, there was just a riot that broke out. I don't think anyone really knows exactly why as of yet. Because they're still trying to sort through the mess, and because of the system being underfunded and the officers not being paid appropriately, they had pretty much 12 officers manning 3 dorms, and each one of those dorms can house up to 260 inmates. So the riot broke out, and they did not have the manpower to control it.
Well, folks on the inside, folks on the inside are saying that they just didn't show up in that. Inmates were left to bleed out for hours.
I have heard reports of that. I haven't confirmed anything. I've been, you know, trying to get more information. Of course, we are waiting for coroner's reports and things like that. But I have heard those reports that no one was able to jump in, which would make sense, seeing as how the riot lasted 7 hours. You know, I mean, I don't know if it was just. No one, you know, a correctional officer wasn't able to jump in and stop it because he didn't want to or because he was afraid to. And he would possibly be overpowered. So, you know, there's no way to know from just off of what we've heard so far.
After massive cuts, South Carolina actually spends less on inmates per capita than any other state in the country. What has the impact of these cuts been on quality of life for folks on the inside in South Carolina prisons?
The quality of life is very poor. You have a lot of, the system is just broken just in general. You have a lot of non-violent offenders who are there on, you know, low-level drug charges, in the same, areas of people who are, you know, very violent offenders. I think that's an issue. You have people being put in solitary confinement for, you know, 23 out of 24 hours. Quality of food is poor. And again, you know, I know people may make the argument, well, they committed a crime, you know, they need to do the time. And I agree. I'm not advocating that it should be a 5-star restaurant, but I think they should be at least, you know, be able to have basic human needs. And a lot of things are lacking, especially mental health care.
And rehabilitation services, right? There are no programs, no education. And then I read that on weekends, they're only fed twice a day. And I use the term fed lightly.
Right. There's nothing, I mean, we are trying to work, you know, to try to correct some of these situations. We're currently trying to work with a lot of other nonprofits, or at least see the interest. And you know, again, it's always sad to have to start delving into a situation once a huge tragedy has happened like this. But I've always wanted to deal with this issue because there aren't very many outlets for those prisoners. I used to work for South Carolina Legal Services, and we can only represent people and who are, you know, do not have enough money to have a lawyer for civil matters. And we would always get letters from people in prison about the conditions, but we weren't, you know, the way our funding was set up, we weren't able to help them. Here at the ACLU, we get a lot of letters as well, but the way our staffing is and the way that the issues come in, and it has to fall under, you know, something that's dealing with the civil rights and making sure that we have all our ducks in a row, it's very, very difficult for them to get representation or for anyone to hear their side of the story or what they're going through.
The prison is saying that the smuggling of cell phones is the cause, and that that's what people were fighting over, and that their response to the rebellion is that they're going to crack down on the smuggling in of cell phones, which usually means that the guard is selling it to people on the inside. Good thing, bad thing, your take on that?
I think it's a cop-out. I mean, if things were running the way that they were supposed to, then cell phones wouldn't be getting in the first place. If they were having, if they had more officers being able to man more areas, then, you know, we have, there's over 600 officer openings at this moment right now. And if we had enough officers, you know, these officers, the current officers that we have, like I said, the riot was 7 hours. 12 officers manning three dorms with 250, 260 inmates. They're doing 12-hour shifts plus overtime. I think the focus needs to be on the fact that the state needs to take a real hard look at where we're spending money and making sure that we're spending money on hiring well-qualified, well-trained officers, making sure that the officers that are already there are being paid adequately. Right now in the budget, the House and the Senate has passed or it has proposed a $750 to $1,000 increase. That's still only bringing the correctional officers up to $34,000 a year.
Well, I have two questions. One, if the folks on the inside didn't have the cell phones, all we would have is the reports of the prison staff,
exactly,
which are not copying to their gross negligence and the fact that they allowed, folks to bleed out on the floor. That's first. And then second, if we're talking about that kind of gross negligence, we're talking about prison guards that are selling cell phones at a cost of almost $1,500 a phone, which on the inside is like, you might as well say $1.5 million. Do we need more of those? Or do we need more humane conditions inside, like rehabilitation programs and school programs and quality food?
I think we need all of it. I don't see a way around one without the other. I mean, because the system as it is set up now, people are just trying to survive. If, you know, those allegations are true and you have correctional officers, you know, making those kinds of, you know, things happen, to me it seems like a survival tactic because there are 300 of them and there's one of me. And I'm getting $30,000 a year, and perhaps I need to make extra money on the side, or I don't want to be the target of anything, or I'm just trying to help out. Whatever the excuse, whatever the reason is, there needs to be well-trained officers. The conditions in the prisons need to be better so that those things do not need to happen. If there needs to be more phones, if there needs to be more of this. And then on the flip side, the one thing that the governor is trying to say is we need to get rid of the cell phones. We want to get in touch with the cell phone companies to jam the signal, because without those cell phones, we wouldn't know the real story that's going on. We wouldn't have seen the conditions. Would we have even known about the riot in time? It took 7 hours with the cell phones. So it's like, you know, a catch 22.
Sandra Scott, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Sandra Scott, executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of South Carolina.
You know what's an alternative?
Not
to
warehousing
prisons?
People in prisons for low-level, nonviolent I'm not even going to use the word crime. I mean, I just like, I do have to say that like we, you know, we prepare for these interviews and we actually originally were going to interview someone who was on the inside that's now doing activism in South Carolina prisons and something happened with the time. But, all of the articles that I read from like other reporters, right, mm-hmm. have all said that they've seen the images of people bleeding out. They've seen the images of the deplorable. So it's not alleged,
right?
It's not that prisoners, inmates, folks on the inside, excuse me, y'all, are making stuff up. So I really need to say that there are egregious, horrible, awful things happening in South Carolina prisons. That Lee Correctional Facility is not unique. That there have been 160 lawsuits since. Since 2015. That's 160 lawsuits in 3 years. Something is going on. They've done massive spending cuts. There's no rehabilitation programs. There's shortages on food. There's shortages on hygiene stuff. And so, yeah, people feel like, you know, they get cut off from their communication. Of course, there's going to be rebellions. I mean, in this particular case, what the people on the inside are saying is that the guards set it up. They caused the beef between these two different street tribes. And this popped off. And then they just were nowhere to be found for 7 hours.
Yeah.
Come on.
I looked up the statistic while you were talking because I didn't want to get in the middle of that conversation.
Smart man.
Current cost of incarcerating a person in California for 1 year, $75,560. That's according to a calculation done by the Associated Press last summer when the governor had his budget request in for the current year.
Just imagine how many young people we could educate, how many people we could house, how many people we could feed, how many people we could provide job training with if we redirected those funds.
Yeah, you think about the housing crisis in the Bay Area. How far would $75,560 to keep people free and housed go versus keeping them incarcerated and warehoused?
Or the unauthorized $30 million that OPD is set to clock in overtime just this year.
Yikes. That takes us to 8:01 in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz. Online around the world at www.kpfa.org. Coming up in the show, really big news.
Really, really, really big news.
That we can't tell you about yet.
And not until 8:50 a.m., 8:47 a.m., according to the run sheet that producer Lucy King put up. But before that, we are going to talk to one of my favorite local artists, Iodeli Wordslinger Nzinga, who's the co-producer and director of One Truliness, which is a new production show by Charlie Levin that looks at, like, it's a multidisciplinary show that has a theme topic. This time is education. The audience participates in the telling of the story while Charlie is painting. Mm. And then as you're looking at it, you think that you're all looking at the same image. And then you find out what happens when we all think we're experiencing the same thing and have a different reality at the end.
I can't wait to find out.
After these news headlines, you will.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. The United Nations Nuclear Agency says it believes Iran had a coordinated nuclear weapons program in place before 2003, but found no credible indications of such work after 2009. The agency issued its assessment a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released what he said was a half ton of seized documents he claimed proved Iran lied about its nuclear intentions.
Incriminating documents, incriminating charts, incriminating presentations, incriminating blueprints, incriminating photos, incriminating videos, and more.
The documents focused on Iranian activities before 2003 and did not provide any evidence that Iran violated the 2015 nuclear deal with the international community. Netanyahu's speech was delivered in English and appeared to be aimed at giving Donald Trump one more reason to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. Trump said the discovery vindicated his criticism of the international agreement.
And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but a lot of people think they know. And on or before the 12th, we'll make a decision.
By May 12th, Trump must decide whether to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal. Israel is widely believed to have a small nuclear weapons arsenal itself, which it neither confirms nor denies. Attorneys representing thousands of former students of the now bankrupt Corinthian colleges were in federal court to restore an Obama-era loan forgiveness program. The Trump administration reversed the program and replaced it with a new formula giving students partial relief based on income. Eileen Connor is an attorney with the Project on Predatory Student Lending. The organization seeks relief for students defrauded by for-profit colleges.
Even when people take advantage of programs like income-based repayment, where they earn so little that they're able to make a $0 payment and be considered in good standing on their loans, it's not curing the difficulty that people are in because the loans are still on their credit reports. There's a psychological impact of having debt, especially when it's the product of an illegitimate school. All of those harms aren't really resolved by income-based repayment.
At its height, Corinthian operated more than 100 campuses in 25 states and enrolled 110,000 students. It collected $1.7 billion in federal student aid. Corinthian folded in 2015 after the Education Department cut off its access to federal aid after determining it lied about student graduation and job placement rates. May Day celebrations around the Bay Area today will focus on immigrants, workers, and renters' rights. In Oakland, Longshore Workers ILWU Local 10 will gather at 10 a.m. at the Oakland Matson Terminal. A 3 p.m. rally takes place at Oakland's Frank Ogawa, also known as Oscar Grant Plaza downtown. In San Jose, demonstrators will gather at 4 p.m. at King and Story Roads. In Concord, a Homes for All campaign seeking relief from soaring rents, evictions, and displacement takes place 4 to 6 p.m. Meadow Homes Park, 1351 Detroit Avenue. In Richmond, immigrants' rights advocates will gather outside the Contra Costa County Jail, which has a contract with federal immigration authorities. Religious leaders will negotiate with authorities to restore a visitation program for undocumented immigrants held at the jail. The event begins at 9:30. In Santa Rosa, demonstrators will gather at 2 with a march at 3:30 to downtown. It's initiative season. Paid signature gatherers and their clipboards are a common sight outside markets and other public spaces trying to sign up enough registered voters to qualify initiatives for the ballot. Most are paid per signature, a practice that Silicon Valley Democrat Evan Lowe wants to end. He says paying per signature creates an incentive to mislead voters or forge signatures.
This fundamentally focuses on getting rid of the incentivizing of such unethical conduct. This bill helps maintain the integrity of the initiative process and still allows for individuals to be paid hourly or by sign pen.
Republican Matthew Harper made the case against Lowe's legislation.
I believe that this would limit the public's participation in the ballot initiative process, and I understand that the state legislature would be interested often in protecting its own turf. This is going to increase the cost for initiative participants. Trying to use some sort of salary or wage effort is going to be more costly instead of the per signature effort.
The assembly approved the bill to ban paying per signature on a vote of 50 to 25. In a big win for labor advocates, the California Supreme Court has limited businesses from classifying workers as independent contractors who can't receive key employment protections. Experts expect the ruling to expand the number of workers eligible for minimum wage, rest breaks, and other benefits under a state wage standard. The court unanimously adopted a broad definition for those who qualify as employees, and the lawsuit that drivers brought against package delivery company Dynamex Operations West. Attorneys involved in the case said the ruling will affect other workers listed as independent contractors, perhaps including those who work for Uber, Lyft, or other such services. An attorney for Dynamex declined to comment. An attorney for the driver said the court adopted a broad definition of what constitutes employment. Newly released documents show that Virginia's largest public university granted the right-wing Charles Koch Foundation a say in the hiring and firing of professors in exchange for millions of dollars in donations to the university. The release of donor agreements between George Mason University and the Koch Foundation follows years of denials by university administrators that Koch Foundation donations inhibit academic freedom. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy in the morning, then sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 60s. In Fresno, in the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers, and afternoon thunderstorms, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary. More news at 94.1 at 8:30.
Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. This is another segment of Radical Art. I'm joined this morning by my friend, playwright, poet, actor, educator, producer, and founder of The Lower Bottom Players, Ayodele Wordslinger in Zynga. Good morning, Ayodele.
Good morning, Oakland. Good morning, world.
Ayodele is producing a new work of art called The One Truthiness, which explores the ways in which our society is fracturing and the different realities of those living through the fractures. In the end, as it says on the website, whose truth wins? Also with us this morning is the creator of One Truthiness, Charlie Levin, a multidisciplinary artist whose work has been presented locally, nationally, and internationally. Charlie's interactive installations, paintings, and performances engage issues of complexity, identity, and perception. Her visual theater company, Local Infinities, co-founder Chicago, created 11 critically acclaimed original works in just 6 years. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
Okay, Charlie, I'm going to start with you. What is One Truthiness about?
One Truthiness jumps into the divide. One Truthiness is how each one of us has our own experiences and our own our worldview, but we're all in the picture together all the time, so we can't have the whole truth unless we talk to each other and see each other.
Now, I know enough about your politics to have heard like 6 things that you could go on a diatribe about for about 10 minutes. What was it about this piece that made you want to take it on as a producer?
The very fact that it tackles the divide. Our current political climate should be really instructive. You know, we either get it right or it could go really, really wrong. And so, how do we do the due diligence to have the discussion across difference? Because what comes if you can't have that discussion across difference and the fracture continues?
What does come? What does come if you can't do that? I mean, you got a lot of black people that talk about creating self-determined communities, that they tired of talking to white people, that we've got to do for ourselves.
Well, what comes after is perhaps the reconsideration of things like power can seize nothing without a demand. But even to make a demand, you have to get in the room. I believe fully in reparations, but before you can get into the mindset of reparating me, then I need an apology. I need an admission of wrongdoing. If you don't understand that you've done wrong, you need your soul washed. Or you need at the very least to sit in my face and look me in my eye and make me understand why your reality is more valid than my reality. Mm. The thing that she says that you cannot escape, no matter how different we are, we're all in the picture together. Mm-hmm. And there's some things that if we don't tend to, they're going to dim the picture, you know? There are all sorts of parables, you know, that we can bring forth. You know, Malcolm said the ballot or the bullet. Mm-hmm. Where do we go if we can't make change? I'm a firm believer in the word. Words create reality and then hide their role in having done so. So if we can bring our words into the same room and we can look at how sometimes those words embody really stupid ideas or ideas that are wrapped so deeply in your survival and there is no threat, or wrapped so deeply in your survival that you've become the threat. And so I don't think we actually do a lot of talking to white people, to tell you the truth. I don't think white people, with all of their politically correctness and wanting to be allies, I don't think they do a lot of talking to black people. I think we talk at each other. You know, I'm big on dialogue and discourse. And so I'm in love with the piece because it offers the ability to come into the room, not talk at, talk to. I think that dialogue and discourse is a precursor to change. I need change.
Charlie Levin, what was the inspiration for the piece?
For me, it was after Ferguson, the rise of Black Lives Matter, that put a lot of images in front of my eyes that as a white person I hadn't been seeing. And I was.
But you said you're from D.C.
I am from D.C.
Chocolate City, with some of the highest levels of police brutality and, like, what is it, 8,000 different law enforcement agencies?
I grew up in the suburbs.
Okay.
I grew up in where there was diversity of ideas. There was some diversity of race, but it wasn't front and foremost. And it was never, and this is what's so striking to me, and this is really the inspiration, is how segregated we are in our cultures. That even paying attention, I lived in Chicago, which is as segregated a city, you know, as can be. I lived in DC and the DC suburbs. I moving here, it's amazing to me how much I don't have to see of what Black people and Black bodies are actually living through day to day. It's for all the thing and paying attention. It didn't come my way until Black Lives Matter really put it front and center. And
what for you did Black Lives Matter put front and center?
The banality and ubiquitousness of death, of how much, and then it's just grown from there. Because once you start paying attention, it's all there to be seen once you start looking. But how much on every level, every day, from small, I mean, we've got words for it, microaggressions, but so many ways in which Black bodies and Black lives are challenged and given static and resistance from the smallest actions of their day to actually having their lives in threat.
And to translate how that hits my ear, she had the privilege of not seeing.
Absolutely.
She didn't have to look. It wasn't her world. It wasn't her reality. But yet it was in the world, same world she was in, bodies falling. And that's what privilege is. You don't have to look. Whiteness, or what's perceived as whiteness, mm-hmm. don't have to see my pain. So when white people step forth and they say they want to be allies, then they've at least got to be in the position Charlie's in, where they realize how wrapped in privilege they've been and want at the very least to divest themselves of the privilege of not knowing. Because I don't think that change can actually occur unless there's some empathetic ground where every time a body falls, it bothers her just as much as it bothers me.
Now I'm gonna push you on that, Ayo. Is that possible that it bothers, and I'm asking, that it bothers Charlie, a white woman and an ally who's come into awareness of the realities of Black bodies? You still can't, Charlie. I'm not talking about you like you're not in a room. You're sitting right here. You still can't understand what the experience of Blackness is. And so while I guess I would agree that we all can feel the pain, right, of seeing a life lost, I don't know that I would say that Charlie would feel that pain of a Black body falling the way you feel it as your kinfolk.
And I say that as a human race. See, Black and white don't really exist. That's a lie we've been told, mm-hmm. that carves that divide, that keeps it static, that enables your statement that she could never feel it as much. I do really Black work from a really Black lens, and I'm doing this work, okay? I do really Black work from a really Black lens because I have the idea that somewhere there's a universal human feel. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm Black, Black first, bleed Black blood, and I will be that way until I'm allowed to be human. Mm-hmm. But I need for her to be human, mm-hmm. truly, fully human. Mm-hmm. So when bodies fall, no matter what color they are, it bothers her. There's a responsibility. There's a feeling of loss, of mm-hmm. indignity and righteous anger. Because in this country where we sit, we are in need of allies, of people who understand and can walk in the right direction. I don't need you to fake the funk. I don't need crazy things like massive rallies that have now come to life that say they need my voice and they can put us in the middle and they'll protect us. I need somebody to link arms and walk out front because they know what's going down, you know? And I believe that for allies truly to be allies, they need to be educated. Black folks have been teaching their whole lives. I'm an educator. That's part of what I do. That's part of the responsibility. Should I have to teach everybody how to be in relationship with me? All I know is that in order to be in relationship with white people who purport themselves as allies, I often find myself in the role of teaching. This work allows me to do some of that teaching. It allows me to be in the room, not just with like-minded people. See, like-minded people sit up together all the time in the room, but change doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But in people who are across the divide that have to cross over, clearly identify themselves. You know, some people want to tell other people how to act. Mm-hmm. I don't want to tell you how to act. I just want to suggest to you what being human looks like, okay? I'm very comfortable with people being who they are. I just need for you to declare it. Don't call yourself an ally if you're not, okay? And so this is, again, the one truthiness is a space where, for me, we get to get white people, and because we're talking black and white now, this piece tackles all kinds of divides. But
we're going to get into that in a minute.
In this arena of black and whiteness, I think a lot of things fall down to race. I think most things fall back to money, and money and race are so closely tied, it's impossible to divide them. Mm-hmm. So in this black and white room, I get to ask white people what you want to do besides feel white guilt. They don't do nothing for me. Mm. I don't have any room for fragility. How are you going to be fragile? Okay? So it's a space in which we can clearly disabuse ourselves of illusions and come as we are and tell our truth. Now, to be honest, we have, that was a very volatile thing. We have talkbacks after, because I don't know where that goes. But if we can't have a conversation, and if we can't come bare naked with our truth, then how are we going to make change? And if we're not going to make change, then perhaps people should be spending their time in some other endeavor rather than trying to change what is.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. This is another segment of Radical Art. I'm joined this morning by producer Ayodele Nzinga and creator Charlie Levin talking about a production called The One Truthiness. Charlie, what are the different fractures that are explored in the piece? We've been focused on race. What else is up in the mix?
Well, the piece, we're presenting this as a quarterly series right now based in Oakland. There have been previous versions, but, as a quarterly series, each, cycle is different content. So the first one dealt with race. It dealt with home. It dealt with safety, and security. When you meet someone, how do you decide whether they're safe or threatening? What are you picking up and looking at? What are the variables? And both ways for white people to realize that they are dangerous. People find them scary. I think that's an eye-opening thing for white people. Just all of the little subtle, small things that we do in our lives that create distance between each other that we're not aware of because we have different normals. So instead of trying to take it as issues and topics and hot-button things, it's looking at the day-to-day thoughts and questions and conflicts and differences and just different perspectives and approaches that end up, regardless of the intentions, end up creating division.
So walk us through the One Truthiness experience. You enter the theater and what?
You enter the theater and the room is dim and there is an illuminated 6-foot square glass panel in the middle of the room. And the room smells of beeswax.
Why beeswax?
The core of the piece is I am painting live in wax on glass. Wax is a translucent medium. I'm a painter. That's my background. As a translucent medium, it's illuminated, it's backlit, it's translucent. So every brush stroke adds to the one before. Nothing, one thing doesn't obscure. It's all about complexity. So you see, watching this emerge and evolve, you see characters created. You see how what they're doing changes meaning when somebody else appears next to them. You see bodies live, you see them die, you see them come together and break apart. But while that's happening, the audience is an equal and active part. There's a book, and that book is compiled of first-person stories of different lived experiences. And I hand that to the audience, and the audience reads it out loud to each other. So you hear a story and you think, oh, I know what that's about. But then you hear the next story and maybe you think, oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. And so the stories are emerging and layering in words, and the voices, you're hearing actual real people in the room, and these are people in your community, and you're seeing the images layer upon layer, and you really, the medium is the message, the experience of being there, being together in a different way than we have the opportunity to be in our daily pragmatic lives. And yet, even though we create everything there together, at the end, I revolve the painting, and I've developed a unique way of painting with wax such that I'm able to layer and hide images in them. So even though you saw every brush stroke, I turn it around and you see something completely different that you couldn't see from your perspective. Oh. So no matter how true and how real our each of our experiences is and how important each of our experiences is, we're all in it together. And until we can grasp that whole, we're not going to come up with solutions that create room for everyone.
This particular installation, what are some of the themes you're exploring?
We started this one with a frame of education.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that as a starting point. So what are the things that you need to thrive? What are the things that you're missing? What are the things that you get in school and formal education? What are the things you get from your family? What are the things you pick up from the world? So what are the obstacles to thriving? What are the things that facilitate it? And again, what are these little things that drive us apart or pull us together?
I'm going to Oaklandize this for a minute. I might have just made up a word there. but the Oakland Unified School District is in incredible debt. It just slashed thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars from their classrooms and their young people. Meanwhile, administrators are still making six-figure salaries. The district is about to, and IOU lived through the first one, the district is about to go back into receivership, albeit modified. Talk about the way in which that for you as a producer, I'm guessing director, plays into this iteration of the piece.
There's one important thing I'd like to bring out too, that this book that's passed around has text in it. It is found text, from Facebook, Twitter, comments, etc., things that she's found that real people have said. Mm-hmm. But even more importantly than that, it's got real people's voices in it. Your voice was captured in Oakland One. We've went around and talked to students. We're headed to a school today. So the voices that address this are very much Oakland voices, Oakland teachers, Oakland students who say things like they're not being taught what they want to be taught. There's the experience also sitting in these classrooms where children write things down that they won't say aloud that really allude to the fact that they're in this room because somehow they think it might keep them alive, literally. I think that the where education is here in Oakland, and as an educator, the number of kids that are being underserved, that are in crumbling facilities, and as you observed, while administrators eat fairly well, is appalling. And if education is the stepping stone to equity, then what are we doing? And I think this piece goes potentially deeper, because what is the role of education? For whom are our children being educated? What is education? You know, is it programming, or is it taking what's in you and enabling you to do extremely well at that? So it's very Oakland, because the voices come from Oakland, real people. But of course, this is a really big conversation, and that's what this work does, is makes really big conversations approachable.
Is there a plan to take it into schools or bring educators and students into the theater? Is there targeted outreach in that way?
Yes.
We're targeting community-based organizations for this particular iteration. We would like for groups to take advantage of super, super group rates to come in and be a part of this. This work needs community voices.
I was just thinking, like, what would it be like to get the Oakland Unified School Board inside of that theater, mm-hmm. along with teachers and some kids, you know, and then force and then see what conversation happens afterwards with those stakeholders experiencing this piece.
Because it equalizes everybody's voice.
Right.
I mean, a prime example would be gun violence and school shootings right now, and the knee-jerk reaction that wants to now arm teachers or put more police on campus, and that experience is so unevenly cut. There have been police officers on campuses in the city of Oakland. This has not always worked out to our advantage. It almost never works out to our advantage when law enforcement is an installation in an institution that we have to go by compulsion.
Right.
So this knee-jerk reaction from on high, does it fit human size?
Okay, and for the important part now, when is it running, where is it running, and where can people get tickets?
May 4th and 5th at the Flight Deck in Oakland. People can get tickets at onetruthiness.com.
There will also be walk-up tickets available at the door. The Flight Deck is located at 1540 Broadway in lovely downtown Oakland.
Conveniently located to the BART and all public transportation.
Yes, and if you happen to miss those shows, this piece is also featured in the San Francisco International Arts Festival starting on May 27th. And again, if you check the website, www.onetruthiness.com, you can find out all the information about this wonderful project, and I will actually get to see you in the room. Looking forward.
You've been listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. This has been another segment of Radical Art. I've been joined this morning by playwright, poet, actor, educator, producer, and founder of the Lower Bottom Players, Ayodele Word, Slanga Nzinga. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Kat.
And also by Charlie Levin, a multidisciplinary artist whose work has been presented locally, nationally, and internationally. Charlie's interactive installations, paintings, and performances engage issues of complexity, identity, and perception. Her visual theater company, Local Infinities, created 11 critically acclaimed original works in 6 years. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you so much, Kat.
And that takes us to 8:31 in the morning. This is Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Teeker.
And I'm Kat Brooks. And up next,
peace on the Korean Peninsula?
Thanks to Donald Trump.
I think the South Korean president is willing to give him credit if it gets the deal done. We'll ask Christine Hong when we come back after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. Donald Trump says it's disgraceful that a list of questions the special counsel investigating Russian election interference wants to ask him was leaked to the news media. The New York Times published the nearly 4 dozen questions given to Trump's attorneys, covering Trump's motivations for firing FBI Director James Comey last May and contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russians. Trump also tweeted, quote, "No questions on collusion. Oh, I see. You have a made-up phony crime, collusion that never existed, and an investigation began with illegally leaked classified information. Nice." But the questions do appear to indicate that Robert Mueller's team is looking into possible collusion, some touch on Russian meddling, and whether the Trump campaign coordinated in any way with the Kremlin. Adult film star Stormy Daniels is escalating her legal fight against Donald Trump. Now she's suing the president for defamation. Stormy Daniels filed the complaint in New York federal court. At issue is a tweet from Trump in which he dismissed a composite sketch that Daniels says depicted a man who threatened her in 2011 to stay quiet about her alleged sexual encounter with Trump. Trump tweeted the sketch was of a non-existent man, and he called the story a total con job. The filing for Stormy Daniels says Trump's tweet was false and defamatory. Her attorney, Michael Avenatti, said they intend on teaching Trump that you cannot simply make things up about someone and disseminate them without serious consequences. The lawsuit is the latest legal move from Daniels, who already is suing to be released from a non-disclosure deal she agreed to days before the 2016 presidential election in exchange for $130,000. On a near unanimous vote, the state assembly has passed legislation to protect immigrants from having their status disclosed in open court without a judge's previous approval. The bill was authored by San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener and San Diego Assemblymember
Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher.
Recently, we've seen a massive drop in crimes being reported from the immigrant community due to a fear that their status will be revealed and they'll be deported. We cannot have a situation which victims are reluctant to report crimes, testify as witnesses, or pursue justice in California courts. This bill has received unanimous bipartisan support in two assembly policy committees.
Assembly members approved the bill on a vote of 67-1. The lone opponent was Republican Travis Allen, who's running for governor on a platform tying himself to the Trump administration's anti-immigrant and anti-sanctuary policies. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy in the morning, then sunny, breezy, highs in the upper 60s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, mostly cloudy, slight chance of showers and afternoon thunderstorms, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news at 94.1 at 10 on Letters and Politics. Join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
Nomi Prince, former Wall Street executive, current investigative journalist, has just brought out a new book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. She has that rare combination of deep knowledge and brilliant writing. Her new work throws unflinching light on the power players and dark conspiracies of international finance. Nomi Prince will speak on Sunday evening, May 6th, 7:30, at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. There's wheelchair access at this KPFA benefit. Vilma V will host. Get tickets at independent bookstores or online at brownpapertickets.com for Nomi Prince, May 6th.
It is 8:35 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And while I was away, it appears the peace may have broken out on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, see? You should go way more often, Brian.
High-level talks on Friday between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. The details of which were reported out from South Korean government sources on Sunday, and it appears that the skeleton of a peace agreement would be as follows. North Korea is offering to abandon nuclear weapons programs in exchange for a promise by the United States never to invade and a formal end to the Korean War, which technically we are still at war in the Korean Peninsula. Second, North Korea is offered to destroy a nuclear testing site and allow international observers to watch that happen, although it's unclear whether that site is still serviceable. It may have been the site of a catastrophic collapse last year. And third, North Korea offering to change its clocks to match South Korea's time zone. Currently, they are 30 minutes apart. Lot of questions here. One question being raised in U.S. media, which seems to be the least relevant one, is whether Donald Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. Another is why North Korea would actually agree to give up its nuclear weapons when the country has seen it as its principal deterrent against a U.S. offensive, U.S. invasion. And the third is, you know, how much trust and credibility can you put into offerings by North Korea? Joining us to get into those questions is Christine Hung, Associate Professor in the Literature Department and the Program in Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at UC Santa Cruz. She's an executive member of the Korea Policy Institute. Good morning.
Good morning.
So first off, like, what's North Korea's incentive to make these agreements? They're not getting invaded now. They seem to have an effective deterrent. What would they get out of giving up their nuclear weapons program?
You know, North Korea in the post-Cold War period has always assumed that peace was in the offing. And, you know, throughout the post-Cold War period has pursued the goal of a peaceful end to the unended Korean War, as well as reunification with South Korea. And, you know, those are two long-standing goals that have defined North Korea as a state. The other thing, too, is just the fact that under Kim Jong-un, his policy moved away from that of his father's. His father's was known as a military first policy. By contrast, his policy is two-pronged. He calls it a Byung-jin policy. It's one that emphasized two tracks toward securing North Korea's future. One was an economic track, and the other one was a military defensive track. So on the one side, you saw the development of the nuclear weapons program to the point where North Korea, in theory, could actually strike the mainland United States. The second track was actually aimed at economically strengthening the society and enhancing the people's livelihood. And so you can see that there's always been this kind of balance. At this particular juncture, North Korea, which has never been able to bring the United States to the negotiating table, actually has taken its military pathway as far as it could go. And it's by doing so that North Korea has actually been able to come to the table to even open up the possibility of there being a discussion for peace.
So there's some skepticism about this coming out of the national security establishment. I'm going to quote from Laura Rosenberg, Rosenberger, who was National Security Council Director for Korea and China under the Obama administration. She's quoting from a 2005 joint statement after six-way talks over North Korea's nuclear program. That statement said, quote, "The United States affirmed that it has no intention to attack or invade the Democratic People's Republic of Korea with nuclear or conventional weapons." And another quote, "The Democratic People's Republic of Korea committed to abandoning all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs." Obviously, the latter did not happen. So why would South Korea or the United States trust it to happen this time?
You know, I mean, there's a running narrative in the American media, and it's aided and abetted by commentary like you just read, that North Korea is an unreliable partner and that you can't actually broker any kind of standing agreement with North Korea. But if you actually look at the history of attempts to get North Korea to decisively abandon the nuclear pathway in the post-Cold War period, you'll see that actually from the North Korean perspective, there was a sequence of what you might call sort of minor regime changes on the U.S. end, which is to say that a liberal president, Bill Clinton, was elected only to be succeeded by George W. Bush, axis of evil president. He had an anti-North Korea policy, got vision in the last part of his late second term, only to be succeeded by Barack Obama. And indeed, Bush also had an ABC policy with regard to North Korea, all but Clinton. So you see that from the U.S. end of things, it's actually the United States that also has not fulfilled its obligations. So it's that kind of one-sided portrait fails to account for the topsy-turviness of the U.S. end of things and the U.S. failure, too, to honor its agreements with North Korea. We're in a very different moment now. I think people need to recognize that. This is the first time that it's not just been North and South Korea that are pushing for a peace accord. This has happened actually before, but it's been flouted by neoconservatives in the White House on the U.S. end of things. Now we have Trump actually giving a thumbs up to the possibility of peace. What this suggests is that behind the scenes, there has been a lot of pre-planning. None of this is going in an unscripted way. And so we have Trump in the triangulated relationship between the Koreas involving always the United States actually giving a green light.
And yet, the Trump administration just elevated John Bolton to the position of National Security Advisor. He is a hawk among hawks, a diehard neocon. Recently was on Fox News Sunday and CBS's Face the Nation, saying he wants North Korea to follow Libya's example from the early 2000s when they dismantled their nuclear program. Anybody with nukes thinking about the Libyan example would, of course, think about the U.S. supporting the NATO airstrikes that helped overthrow Muammar Gaddafi's government and led to his death. That cannot be a terribly appetizing prospect for North Korea.
Well, I mean, you know, many people have commented that Trump has been assembling a war cabinet. There's Pompeo, there's Bolton. I mean, and they're absolutely right. The fact of the matter is, though, that North Korea From its perspective, if it were to hammer out a permanent peace agreement, it'd much rather have the hawks at the table versus someone like Tillerson, who didn't have the backing of the American president. And so this is the other thing that I'll say. And, you know, it's true. Like, North Korea has always had its eye on Libya and Iraq, two catastrophic U.S. Interventions that left in their wake massive humanitarian catastrophes. In the case of Libya, as you just mentioned, Libya gave up its nuclear weapons. But the fact of the matter is, if the United States had a military option, it likely would have exercised it. The fact of the matter is that when Donald Trump was actually threatening, you know, so we're having like whiplash in this moment because Donald Trump went from a would-be genocidaire to someone that people are clamoring for the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, he went from saying that he would totally destroy North Korea. Now, anyone who understands the tiniest bit about geography knows that even a conventional military option for the North would have a catastrophic impact on the South. The distance between Pyongyang and Seoul is negligible. It's really like, you know, peace activists for years have said in their songs that it's merely a cab ride away. And so, you know, if that were really and truly an option for the United States, it would have to be willing to collateralize the lives of millions of South Koreans, South Korea being a longstanding U.S. ally.
One of the things that I've been wondering about this is that with the unification of North and South Korea, what does this do potentially to U.S. influence in the region?
You know, I think that is such a great question. You know, we saw Barack Obama coming into office, you know, stating that if historic U.S. foes uncurled their fists, the United States would gladly reach out a hand. With regard to Iran, with regard to Cuba, you could see that there was this thawing of relations with the United States actually reaching out a hand and, you know, historic foes, you know, also reaching out as well. In the case of North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un, in his New Year's address, actually stated when Barack Obama came into power, he made an overture in his New Year's address towards the possibility of peace with the United States. But Barack Obama took to a studiously neoconservative path with regard to the Asia-Pacific region. This is called the pivot policy, and insisted, and this was Hillary Clinton was an architect of this, that there it was absolutely necessary that the United States build upon its existing militarized infrastructure in the Asia-Pacific region. It was a region that during the Cold War saw two devastating hot wars, and that it needed to do so to secure its economic primacy within the region. And so what you have here is you actually have Trump, you know, potentially undoing. So he's getting a lot of mileage from undoing. He's an all but Obama policy person. He's getting a lot of mileage from undoing the policy of his predecessor, but it's also one that undoes the infrastructural sort of dominance of the United States in the region. And I think that we have to reckon with the fact that the United States actually doesn't have the capacity to sustain an incredibly bloated military presence around the world. The entire sort of fiction of full-spectrum dominance in this particular moment, if you even look at the national defense strategy that was released just recently, you can see that the military presence, the sort of vision for it, is much scaled back. It's not an axis of evil moment. You see a very different, even military-industrial complex, reckoning with the capacity of the United States to be full frontal in terms of its war posture around the world.
All right. Christine Hung, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christine Hung teaches at UC Santa Cruz. She's on the executive board of the Korea Policy Institute. That takes us to 8:48 in the morning. Time to break some very big news here on KPFA. I don't know if we've done an adequate job of building the tension. Kat Brooks is not going to be hosting on these airwaves for the next 6 months and 4 days. at a minimum. Kat Brooks, would you care to tell them why?
I am. I would. Not used to being on this side anymore. So for the last 6 to 12 months, that's 12 months, people from various sectors of the community, labor, grassroots activists, teachers, pastors, spiritual folks, have been suggesting that perhaps I should consider a run for the mayor of Oakland. And I said, no, 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 no. And then I said, yes. And so today I am announcing officially my candidacy for the mayor of the city of Oakland.
So this is your declaration?
This is my declaration.
You are now a mayoral candidate.
I am now a mayoral candidate.
That means you are no longer a host and you are a guest for the remaining 10 minutes of this program.
Yes, it does.
So folks, in accordance with our internal policies and the regulations we face as an FCC licensed non-commercial broadcaster, we will be reaching out to all other candidates for the mayor of Oakland and offering them a chance to do an interview in the next few days. I say that by way of fairness. Kat Brooks, having just broken the news on KPFA, what kind of campaign is this? Are you running to win or are you running to make a point?
Both and. It's not a zero-sum game, right? So at first I thought about running not to make a point either. It's not to make a point. It's to organize the masses of Oakland who can't afford to purchase power in City Hall, right? It's about unhoused voices. It's about black voices that are being pushed out. It's about immigrant voices. It's about poor voices. It's the people that have for the last 4 years borne the brunt of a neoliberal mayor who has put development over people. And Oakland has been on the vanguard of resistance for decades. We continue to be in the vanguard of resistance, and it is in Oakland where we can demonstrate to the country what resistance looks like. And so this is a people's campaign. Again, I didn't make the decision to run on my own. I was asked to run by the people. This is about talking about the housing crisis like the epidemic that it is. This is about challenging the fact that the Oakland Police Department is set to clock $30 million of unauthorized, unbudgeted funds in overtime. This is about the fact that we've got a police department with a legacy of rape and murder. This is about the fact that we've got development policies that are pushing black and brown people and poor people out of the city of Oakland. And how do we galvanize those voices and organize those voices so that win, lose, or draw, we have an organized base to push for saving the soul of the city of Oakland.
What's your top priority?
I bet you could guess that one. Is diverting, not completely eliminating, but diverting. The Oakland Police Department gets 50% of the general fund. Or just think about that. 50% of the general fund to not keep us very safe. And so what does it look like if we take half of that, if we take 25% of the general fund that the OPD gets and we redirect that to housing, to education, to job training programs? That's a whole new Oakland. That's prevention. When are we going to get to a place in the city, in the state, in this country where we're focused on prevention rather than criminalization and incarceration? It's time to change. It's time to turn the tables. And that's not what Kat Brooks says. That's what mountains of research says keeps communities actually safe.
Yeah. Every time I talk to someone in Oakland, there's like two things that come up. One is the extent to which the rents are skyrocketing.
Yep.
The other is the extent to which the homeless encampments that are now under every freeway pass
yep.
are sprawling out. Let's take them one at a time. A quarter of the police budget is a lot of money. It is not enough to house everybody in deed-restricted affordable housing. What do you think city government can and should do about the cost of housing?
So I don't buy the argument because of what I just said earlier, just a moment ago, that OPD is set to clock $30 million in unauthorized overtime. We have the money. We're just not directing it. We need to be dealing with the unhoused crisis in the city like a bomb dropped into the middle of our city. Because it did. Identification bomb has dropped into the center of the city of Oakland. And we need to be redirecting all of our resources. We need to build 4,000 affordable units tomorrow. Right. There should be nothing else that we're talking about in terms of what we're doing with city dollars than housing our unhoused residents. And I don't understand how any humane, socially conscious government anywhere in the country, not that Oakland is unique, there are unhoused populations exploding everywhere as the wave of gentrification rides America. But we have to take a stand. We have to take a stand on the side of our most vulnerable residents.
If you started the process of building 4,000 units tomorrow, it would be years before they were actually constructed, ready to move into. What about the encampments in the meantime?
So in the meantime, we need to be providing our encampments with bathrooms, with portable showers, with medical support. We need to be with heaters. You name it. We need to be ensuring that it is the most humane possible living conditions and stop sending police to destroy encampments and terrorize people that don't have homes to sleep.
What do you say to a neighbor who says, I agree with that in principle, this encampment in my neighborhood is not in a good spot. I don't want my kid stepping over needles on their way home from school.
Well, that's the part. So that's the part of the city is to aid and abet, right, folks in the camps, to keeping the camps clean. Like, we can redirect resources to doing that. But no, we don't get to say in Oakland that our neighbors, our brothers, our sisters, our siblings, our persons, 80% of whom, of the 3,000 people that are asleep on these streets, were formerly housed people in Alameda County. We don't get to say to them that you don't get to be here because I don't feel like looking at you. If you don't feel like looking at your unhoused neighbor, then pull up your sleeves, pitch in, and do the work of getting unhoused people housed.
So homeless people living under the freeway overpasses, that's the extreme case of the housing crisis. Then there are the tens of thousands of people who are one rent hike or one Ellis Act away from being on the streets or out of Oakland or choosing between the two themselves. What would you do to protect people who are in place and precarious?
I think we need to strengthen and increase voter protections, excuse me, tenant protections. I think as a city, we need to get, I really support and appreciate what Rebecca Kaplan has done in terms of throwing full support behind the repeal of Costa Hawkins, and we need to close loopholes for landlords.
What about right to counsel, like San Francisco's considering? Everybody who's facing eviction gets a lawyer paid for by the city.
I'm with it.
She's taking positions right now, folks.
That's a no-brainer. I'm with it.
So, like, bigger question. You identify and have identified on this program as a police abolitionist. Mm-hmm. As mayor, you would be in charge of a large police department. Can you be those two things at once?
Absolutely. It's both. Where can we practice abolition in our day-to-day lives now, right? Like, where do we not need to involve police? Police should not be the solution to every single issue. And I've said constantly and consistently for anybody that's listened to me on a regular basis that it's radical reform on the way to abolition. That's why diverting 25% of those general funds to things that actually keep people safe and on the preventative end, that's one step towards that, right? Like, we should be actively walking away from militarized policing and incarceration. You know, people say, well, what about, how are we going to keep safe? Let's evaluate what that means, right? The homicide solve rate for the Oakland Police Department is just a little over 30%. Right? We just saw that horrible story, and people take it in a bunch of ways. You know, that I don't know why it was headline news, because it happens to Oaklanders every single day in terms of property crimes, right? The cars, et cetera, get broken into on a consistent basis. What does it look like to redirect funds to community ambassadors? What does it look like to train up community members for community safety while at the same time, right, reforming and holding accountable and making transparent the Oakland Police Department, finally, for the first time in that department's history?
Yeah. Could you ever see yourself? I'm going to engage in a hypothetical here. The police shoot someone. There is irrefutable video evidence that that person was shooting at the police first. Could you ever see yourself saying that was a justified use of force?
I can see myself saying we need to be having conversations about compassionate policing and continuing to ask the question that if we can take Nicholas Cruz, if we can take Timothy McVeigh, if we can take Dylan Roof, and the list goes on of white men with guns who commit egregious crimes, if we can find a way to de-escalate and take them to jail alive, that there is no reason why police can't do that in more and more, if not every single situation.
Another hypothetical, you talked about the campaign as an organizing effort. Let's say you don't win. What is left of your campaign? What endures starting the day after Election Day?
Hopefully a base of 10,000 people mobilized to run an agenda for progressive Oakland.
All right. Kat Brooks, I don't know if I can even wish you luck, because we're a 501c3 and I am a broadcaster. I can say I admire you. I have enjoyed the hell out of every day we work together. And I am looking forward to working with you again in the next 6 months to 8 years.
Thank you, Brian.
Kat Brooks was the host of Upfront. She will be the host on leave of Upfront for at least the next 6 months and 4 days. She just declared on this radio program that she is running for mayor of Oakland. In the interest of fairness, we will be reaching out to every other person who is running in that race to offer them equal airtime within the next week. For now, that does it. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on KPFA. You can find archives of the show at kpfa.org. Get in touch by emailing us at upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to our producers on today's show, Corinne Smith and Lucy King. Our engineer, Kirsten Thomas. Hosts are Salima Hamarani on Fridays. And me, Brian Edwards, Tinker, kind of lonely here. A big thanks as well to our intern, Justin Gold, and to Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandari. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way at 9 a.m.
is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending May 13th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. The book launch of Road Warrior, Poems of the Inner and Outer Landscape, takes place on Monday, May 7th at 6:15 p.m. at the Aquas Cafe in Petaluma. Open mic follows the reading at 189 H Street in Petaluma. For details, call 707-778-6060. The opening reception for Calvita, Nature as Sustenance, takes place on Friday, May 11th from 6 to 9 p.m. The exhibition is located at K Gallery, 2513 Blanding Avenue in Alameda. For details, call 510-865-5060. Attitudinal Healing Connection presents Igniting Change Through Creativity on Saturday, May 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. This 20th annual Art Esteem exhibition program promotes art and social justice for youth. The event takes place at 1960 Mandela Parkway in West Oakland. For details, call 510-652-5530. The community calendar is produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To get this calendar again, call 510-848-6767 extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
KPFA, KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF.